My first introduction to Plastic Free July was challenged to fit all of my month's plastic into a mason jar, like a standard size mason jar. On my first day, I failed because I went and got groceries. It was very discouraging, I'm not going to lie, in that moment, as someone who was very new to, you know, sustainability and to who was just kind of waking up to the impacts of plastic on our environment. So, you know, going to a grocery store and having my mason jar in mind, I was like, oh, I can't buy this box of strawberries or my snacks or my yogurt or literally everything in that grocery store is in plastic for the most part, even your fruits and vegetables.
It's episode 70 of Dive in the Podcast with special guest Natasha Tucker. Dive in the Podcast is a weekly all about diving podcast for everyone. Whether you explore the ocean as a snorkeler, scuba diver, free diver, tech diver, Dive In has something for you. The show is filled with diving news, feature interviews with guests from around the world, interesting dive topics, and ocean advocacy. Visit diveinpod.com to find out more about the show, past guests, and our Patreon. Hi, everybody. I'm Justin.
I'm April, and on tonight's pro tip, I'll tell you about something I learned on my last dive.
I'm Nick, and my book recommendation is about blending diving gases.
I'm Amit, and we're the hosts of Dive in the Podcast.
Before we start today's episode, we'd like to thank you, our listeners. Thanks for tuning in every week. Your support encourages us to keep going and make a bigger, better podcast. Thank you. What did you guys think about the interview with last week with Jadon Law?
I had a blast doing that interview.
I was missing in action because I was diving for some work. And since I haven't listened to the rough cut yet, I can only go by what you guys are saying.
You know what? I really liked his energy, man. He was laid back, but passionate. And, you know, yeah, like he's doing work that how would you know about a guy doing this kind of work unless Nick went out and found him, right? So, obviously, if you're in Jamaica, you might know. But, I thought it was just fantastic and a great example of that. You know, let's find local divers doing really cool stuff and highlight them on the show. And the guy was just cool. So, you know, I like that. I enjoyed that episode quite a bit.
Yeah, I did too. He was awesome and makes me want to go to Jamaica even more now. We'll visit him and Janelle, all one trip. We'll get them both.
And like you said, let's do it like the right way, right? Like, so let's, we'll skip the resorts. We'll get all the recommendations from him.
Skip the touristy stuff. Yeah, we'll do legit stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, you got the real feeling and, with the people and all that. And I think that's what some dive destinations for scuba divers are missing, that connection with the locals.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's cool. Without question, yeah. And I mean, I'd love to see more of it without a doubt. And that idea that he kind of tossed around for building that conservation group and generating funds where he would attract divers for an authentic Jamaican experience.
I think authentic trips to Jamaica are totally sellable, and I hope they proceed with that as soon as we can get trips going to Jamaica again. So if you haven't listened to the episode with Jadon, hop on into the Wayback Machine, push backwards 1 week, and check it out. It's good episode, and you will not regret it. Speaking of things you won't regret, we had a guest back in episode 60, Gary McGraw. Nick, what's going on with Gary?
Gary, who's a British freediver, along with Harry Chamas, who's also another British freediver and coach, they're starting their own podcast. They're going to be tackling specific freediving topics from the perspective of professional athletes and coaches. And the new freediving podcast called The In-Depth Freediving Show. And their new podcast called The In-Depth Freediving Podcast. You can check it out on Spotify, and it should be available on Apple Podcasts too. So we'll include a link. You can check it out on Spotify, and it should be available on Apple Podcasts soon. I think they had some propagation issues there initially, but it should be available by the time you listen to this. And we'll include a link to it on their in the show notes and to their Instagram account as well. And, we kind of ran through the gauntlet starting a podcast. So we wish them all the best with their venture. And I look forward to listening to it.
Yeah, most definitely. Give it a listen. I already have subscribed and looking forward to listening to the first episode. Nick, you've got a shout out for us this week.
I do. I got a message on my personal Instagram account from a person called Austin Gordon Aquatic Media. I'm assuming it's Austin Gordon. a freediving photographer based out of Cincinnati in the US, and wrote to me just briefly saying that they love the work that we do here with the crew on Dive in the Podcast, and said, I quote, "It's honestly been one of my favorite podcasts to listen to," end quote. So we really appreciate any feedback we get. You're asking us to keep it up, and we're certainly going to hope to keep meeting that standard. And thank you for the comment. We always appreciate hearing from our listeners what they think about the show. So shout out there to Austin Gordon.
Thanks there, Austin. Appreciate the kind words. And if you've got kind words for us, or even if you don't have kind words for us, you can always send them to our Instagram, our Facebook, or our Facebook group. And if you've got super kind words, you should leave a review on our podcast on Apple Podcast or Podchaser. Sorry, shameless plugs. Anyway, all right. Let's head over to our guest tonight. Tonight, we're speaking with Natasha Tucker. Natasha is a local Nova Scotian sea fox diver. She's a fierce ocean advocate who has volunteered for a number of ocean causes. She's the executive director of Plastic Oceans Canada, a member of the board of directors for Back to the Sea Society, and a volunteer with the Fishing Gear Coalition of Atlantic Canada. Welcome to the podcast, Natasha. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Awesome. Well, we're happy to have you here too, and we're happy to get into this interview. But before that, we got a little bit of news. What's the deepest pool you've ever gone scuba diving in, Natasha?
Oh, that's a good question. I have to think. I want to say it's the NewTek here in Dartmouth. 12 feet, I think, is what we said. It's probably the deepest.
Yes. Yeah. Well, there's a new pool. It's a little deeper. It's in Dubai. It is just 200 feet. So it's close, but
close.
Yeah. And so according to a CNBC article, it says, quote, "Dubai is already home to the world's tallest building. Now it's time to lay claim to the world's deepest pool, too." So if you're interested in like scuba diving or free diving, you've probably heard this, saw these videos posted the other day on social medias. I think even Will Smith was hired to do some TikTok videos from the poolside there, which is that crazy Dubai money. if you're gonna launch a pool and fly Will Smith out to do that for you. That's pretty cool. So it's 200 feet. That's 60 meters. That's significantly deeper than I can free dive or scuba dive. And it's got all this crazy stuff inside of it. They've got foosball table, pool table. They've got hallways decorated like, I don't know, it looked like the computer core off a Star Trek ship or something. There's so much going on there. These trees growing out of it. I've just seen some of these pools and they're, you know, they just look like deep pools, or they look like a missile silo and pretty, you know, pretty straightforward, you know, hole in the ground. But this thing is totally decorated from the bottom to the top. They obviously spared no expense and it's super cool. So check out the video in the article linked in the show notes and learn all about it. And maybe if you go, let us know if you're headed to Dubai to go diving in that pool. Shoot us a message in our DMs or an email, and we'll share that awesome story.
Man, that sounds so cool. I need one in my backyard.
Mm. I'm just waiting for somebody to come up with one that's going to be like 250.
201.
I know.
I see your 200.
That's right.
Exactly. Everybody's
Can you
racing.
Imagine? I was going to say, can you imagine being like going in the tallest building and then in the same day, like going to the deepest pool? Mm.
Would you have to stop, breathe some oxygen? No, I don't know.
I was going to say,
you probably would.
Could you go? No, yeah, you couldn't go to altitude. You probably couldn't go to altitude. No, I don't know.
You wouldn't be able to, I don't think.
I mean, those high speed elevators shooting up.
Yeah, going up. Ooh. And then going. Well, I mean, Dubai is definitely the land of opulence. I mean, I think these guys, if I'm not mistaken, have Bugatti Veyrons for their police department. Which is like, you know, $1 million vehicle. It is like, well, at one point was one of the fastest cars in the world. So, you know, it's pretty intense if that's what you're getting to drive around with and you're just the local street police.
But it's to catch all the other people driving really fast, expensive cars.
Well, and you know what? Maybe it is. Who knows? Who knows?
I'm guessing.
I guess everybody has. Yeah. Well, I think one of the, is it the princes there? That might be in Saudi Arabia who had like, some. One of their cars, like one of these like crazy cars, like the supercars built out of like platinum, because he just wanted it to be silver, but like legit silver, I think. So
real silver. Yeah.
I mean,
that's awesome.
It's that oil money. Yeah. It's that oil money.
That's hilarious.
I think they could handle the podcast pension if we could get a Prince of Dubai to sponsor us.
Sponsor. So,
that's true.
Yeah. There we go.
Dear Mr. Prince of Dubai, please subscribe to our Patreon.
Please follow us on Patreon. We'll set a new tier up for you. It'll be called the Prince tier.
Prince of Dubai tier. Only $1 million a month.
That's right.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, it probably
Canadian, wouldn't. So it's basically nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Basically nothing comparatively.
Awesome.
That's
awesome.
Good.
Well, I think that's it for the news today. I think it is time to dive in with Natasha Tucker. So, Natasha, where are you from?
I'm from the Valley, actually, a small town called Berwick. It's the Apple Capital. Ah. You may have heard of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have.
Lived there for quite a few years, but I like to move around a little bit. So I've hopped around from a few provinces and found my way back here a few years ago. So I'm living in Halifax now.
Awesome.
Very cool. When I played Ringette, our nemesis was Berwick, so I'm familiar.
They're hardcore. Did you ever play at the Barn in Berwick?
No, I always played at the brand new arena. Yeah, I was at the brand new arena, which I guess isn't that brand new anymore, but it's more new than the Barn, I guess.
I've never been in it before. I won't go in it. It's my allegiance to the Barn. I can't. It was a very big deal. Many rivalries went down there. Not that I played them personally, but
no, I don't know. I have this like inside of me burns when I hear the name Berwick because I just think of Ringette,
our
nemesis team. Yeah, we went from friends to rivals from second,
very fast. I'll see you on Women's Dive Day.
Yeah,
that escalated quickly. I think is the
I know. Yeah, wow, we got to separate these two for sure.
Let me at her. I'm going to throw some rings down for you to dive and catch.
Yeah, I'll bring my stick.
Oh, is that a threat?
Well, I guess being from Berwick, what was your first memory of the water, Natasha?
Honestly, it's funny because as a kid, I went to the ocean, you know, here and there, but I really enjoyed swimming, but I don't remember, you know, ever spending a lot of time there when I was growing up in Berwick, even though we lived right on the Bay of Fundy. You know, my first real memory of the ocean, I would say, was in Newfoundland. I went to go visit. My dad he's RCMP, and he lived in this very small town. And we went there, and there's this beautiful, like, dock you could jump off of. It's in a small town called Twillingate. Newfies probably know this very well because it's in a very popular Newfie song.
Yeah.
But I think that was really my first memory of like going into the ocean willingly and swimming in the ocean. Because, you know, Bay of Fundy, you don't really want to swim there. It's a little intense with the tides and everything. So, yeah. So that was really when I had my first experience like swimming in the actual ocean. But I mean, prior to that, I grew up in the water. My dad called me a fish. I was in swimming lessons as early as possible and maxed out all of my swimming lessons, you know, before I could even become a lifeguard when I was too young. Right. So,
right.
I've always been in love with the water, but the ocean kind of freaked me out a little bit. I'm not going to lie.
Even though you grew up close to the ocean, did some of your thoughts about your passion for the ocean maybe come later?
Yeah, definitely did. I know for me, a big turning point was when I moved to Vancouver. I remember this so clearly. Like I moved to Vancouver in the beginning of August, and one of the very first things I did was go to the Vancouver Aquarium. And for me, that was just a game changer. You know, again, like I grew up near the ocean, but was a little freaked out by what I couldn't see. So, you know, something touches your leg, it freaks you out a little bit. But going to the aquarium was a really, really eye-opening experience for me. You know, I know so many people go to a place like that to see the big animals, the marine mammals, and, you know, the dolphins, the whales, if they're there, and the otters and all of that. And I mean, not going to lie, that's definitely what drew me in. But my experience after visiting the first time just completely changed my outlook, and just sparked a really, really fiery passion for me to just get involved. You know, I've grown up being more of an animal welfare advocate. So, you know, caring for the animals in that regard, and then just seeing, you know, the rescue missions of facilities like the aquarium just really helped me connect the two and made me want to get involved.
Seeing all that and being involved, is that where the diving came in, or did that come from a different place?
No, it definitely came from being in the aquarium, because I think really through my experience volunteering and working there, it made me realize that it's not that scary. Mm. You know, the animals that you encounter, they're not much to be afraid of. I can recall, you know, a snorkeling excursion that I did in Mexico, and I'm so mad at myself now because I was literally swimming with sea turtles off like the resort, you know, not even a paid trip or anything. And then I recall like looking, and I think I saw a barracuda and was like, I'm out, I'm done. Like, I don't care about this family of sea turtles in front of me. I'm going to get eaten by this barracuda. So it's just like purely from a lens of, you know, just not understanding. Yeah. So yeah. That was something that the aquarium experience really taught me, was like, it's not anything to be scared of. You know, sharks aren't out there to hurt you. They're probably, you know, they might come up to you, but they're not going to eat you. So that really helped change my perspective for sure, and got me involved in diving. You know, seeing all the divers do, you know, their husbandry and, you know, entertaining the visitors, it just made me really want to have my own experiences underwater.
Well, so then where'd you learn to dive? And do you remember what your first like ocean dive was?
Oh yeah, 100%. I will never forget this. I had to have a pep talk because it was in Vancouver. It was at this beautiful spot. You guys probably have heard of it. It's called White Cliff Park. It's absolutely stunning. And I remember my first time going in the ocean with all of my gear. I'm not a claustrophobic person. I'm really not. But the breathing kind of freaked me out. And we had to do the exercise in our dive training where you have to take your rag out and you have to try and find it again. And that, for some reason, even though I knew like my backup was right there, like it just freaked me out. So I shot to the surface. I know you're not supposed to do that. I know. I haven't done it since, but I just remember that. And then even the instructor had to come up and be like, he had to give me some like really tough love. You had to be like, listen, you're either going to do this or you're not. You're going to go down, you're not going to do that again, or you're going to get out and we're going to have to retry this another time. What's your choice? I was like, okay, well, this is a now or never moment. So I did it. And it was probably one of the hardest things I've ever had to do, to be honest, because it just freaked me out so much.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was rewarded after, because after we finished all of our skills and everything, you know, we went for our fun dive. And I told the instructor that I really wanted to see an octopus, a giant Pacific octopus. I'm fascinated by them. And, you know, we were down there and we were about to turn our dive and he found me an octopus. And it was probably one of the coolest things I've ever seen underwater to this day. It's just fascinating. So, yeah, my very first dive was very, very memorable for me.
Wow. That's what a find on your first dive. That's great.
Awesome yeah, it was dive. Awesome. Right. Are there any octopus? I haven't seen octopus here.
I've never seen one here, but I'll tell you, the ones in Victoria, that they're still ranked up there and one of the coolest things that I've seen too, that giant Pacific. And I like the moxie of this instructor of yours here with the do or, is he like a Yoda like guy? A do or don't do, there is no try.
Pretty much. Yeah. So. It was just what I needed in the moment, you know, that little bit of tough love to push through, because you know, that was exactly what happened. Cause for me, I was like, all right, you know, that's a solid point. And I just spent a lot of money on this course. So, and I know I really want to do this. So I'm going to be very mad if I don't. And again, like I said, I was rewarded with that incredible, you know, opportunity to see an octopus, which I know is, you know, a bit of a rarity. So, very, very fortunate.
And I mean, obviously BC is cold water. But after you got certified, did you do a lot of your diving in cold water, or was it more warm water? Or what has your diving been like?
I have actually only ever dove in cold water. I've never done a warm water dive. I travel, I mean, pretty frequently. Well, I used to. I mean, you know, COVID kind of screwed that up. But you know, every time I've gone to a warmer destination, I mean, I'm usually the only diver in my group. So I've never actually been able to, you know, get one together, or, you know, or it hasn't been worth it in the moment, you know. You know, I've been at a spot where the diving isn't that great. So I've actually never done it. So my diving experience is really limited to Vancouver and here in Halifax.
Sounds like you got to come on Blackbeards with us.
Wow. I can't wait for a warm water dive.
You're good and seasoned. Yeah. Like when when you go to warm water, it's going to be a walk in the park.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I've heard. So Blackbeards, who knows?
Yeah, you know that. Okay. Blackbeards.
Shameless 2022.
Just get me on a plane.
I'll forget all this Berwick stuff if you come on Blackbeards with me.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. We can put it behind us. We'll see.
Yeah, we can put it behind us. So speaking of that, you're out diving with the local clubs all the time, like the Sea Foxes. What draws you to that community?
Really, how welcoming everyone is. You know, like I got certified quite a while ago, but I had quite a long hiatus because, to be frank, like moving to a new area where I didn't know anyone and also being a new and experienced diver, like it's intimidating, you know. Dive groups can be intimidating if you don't have, you know, an in a way. And even, you know, seeing the Sea Foxes, I remember my first time in Torpedo Rays, I forget who I was talking to. It might've been Jason, and you mentioned the Sea Foxes. And I was like, oh, a women's dive group. This is amazing. But like, what's a women's dive group going to be like? Because, you know, big groups of women, you know, you don't know. You know, I was so shocked. I think one of my first dives that started me back up again, we're coming up on 1 year, it was Women's Dive Day last year. That's when I got back into it and more consistently. And I think that really showed me how welcoming the community is and how, you know, you don't need to be an expert. It's okay to be a beginner and it's okay to ask questions. And I think for me, that was really what made me feel part of the group, even though it was my first time. You know, everyone was so friendly, and I've really come to value and appreciate the group that we have here.
Nice.
So good job, April.
Oh, well, it's people like you that make it all happen.
That's really awesome. So from either coast, either locally or out west, do you have any favorite dive sites?
You know, I really enjoyed the White Cliff. Again, I think that octopus thing just like tops it for me. It was such a cool experience. But I also, here, I love all of the dive sites. I find every time I go somewhere, I find something different that really stands out for me. You know, one in particular that I find, you know, we don't go to as often, but I hold it in very high regards, maybe because I just had a really great experience this one time, but it was Mill Cove. I remember we did this dive. I don't think, April, you were here for it. It was last year before we did the dumpster dive, the trash collection one last year. Mm-hmm. So we did Mill Cove, and I just remember, I think I saw an American eel, and I thought that was just one of the coolest things I've ever seen. And I loved getting in and amongst all of the seagrass and all of that stuff there, and found some really cool looking fish. So that one's always been very high up on my list too. For me, it's really just, I just love seeing creatures. So really any site where I'll see something cool, I always hold it in high regard.
I think Mill Cove is like underrated. It's, to me, it's totally like a like better Fox Point, because it's like Fox Point, but everywhere. Like so much.
Exactly.
More. Yeah.
I just remember looking and I was like, there's just so much to look at. Like, where do I start?
Yeah. No, I know. Yeah, Mill Cove is good. We need to dive there more. I feel like we never go there.
Do.
It's a good site.
Next Sea Fox dive after dive. Dive day.
So for the listeners, Fox Point is a classic beach with rocks on the side, where divers kind of go out on rocks on their one side, come back rocks on the other, and if they want to chase some critters in the sand, they might go in the sand. But Mill Cove is next to a fisherman's wharf, and there's oftentimes stuff in the water there, and all rocky and full of life, and you can find everything there. And it gets a little deeper, a little faster too. So it's cool sites. Sorry, just That's jumping cool in there site. To share the information for those not local to Nova
Thank
Scotia.
You for the description in less than 1,000 words.
Oh man, that's awesome. I'm changing track a little bit here, and I want to ask, you volunteered quite a bit on marine mammal rescues. Tell us a little bit about that experience and how that's kind of shaped where you are now.
Yeah, I mean, volunteering with Marine Mammal Rescue was a sobering experience. Like, you know, everyone wants to volunteer. You know, that's kind of your starting ground at the aquarium, is to start somewhere there, doesn't matter what, so that you can become a Marine Mammal Rescue volunteer. It's like the pinnacle of the volunteer experience there. And I was no different. I mean, of course, who doesn't want to get hands-on experience with adorable animals? So, I mean, it's really an interesting approach to it, because, you know, here I know we have Hope for Wildlife, and, you know, there aren't a lot of seal rescues here, versus on the West Coast, where, you know, I think on average there's probably about 200 seal pups a year that get rescued. So it's for a variety of reasons. Many of them are just abandoned on beaches, whether or not they are purposefully abandoned and mom just hasn't come back, or oftentimes it is because of human intervention. But it was really sobering, just because, you know, you see how these issues that we're currently facing in our ocean are affecting the animals. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, what really got me involved in all of this, and really the root behind everything that I do, is animal welfare. So seeing how, you know, our issues have trickled down and affected these animals who have literally nothing to do, and they're not doing anything wrong, they're just in the wrong place at the wrong time. So, you know, I haven't personally been on these missions where, you know, because I'm not qualified, but there are veterinarians that, you know, go out into the field and take like packing straps off of sea lions' necks that they've gotten entangled and just grown into, and they are just huge lacerations in their necks. So they go out and they sedate them and remove them. So, you know, you really see that kind of impact, and it's just devastating, you know? So, I mean, the most of the patients, like, they're humans, but most of them are little baby seals who just don't have mom around, and maybe they have injuries. Most of them can be released, thank goodness, unless they have really, you know, if they're visually impaired, you know, if they're blind in both eyes, or if they have some other things that hinder their success in the wild. But, you know, I have also seen, you know, adult sea lions who are perfectly healthy before, but have been, you know, shot in the head and are permanently blinded. And that is just, it really makes you question human behavior and why people do the things that they do. And but it also, again, as sobering as it is, it's also incredibly motivating to, you know, be a part of that change and be a part of that education and outreach to share with people what we're doing to these animals, just because it does, you know, all of our actions have an impact in some way, shape, or form, and we just maybe aren't always aware of it. So that was quite the experience. Loved every second of it. I mean, most of it was spent tube feeding seals disgusting fish formula and cleaning their tubs of really oily excrement. So not glamorous, but really cool, you know, getting up close with these animals. You know, we had some green sea turtles come through who were shocked because of the cold, and some fluffy, cute little baby sea otters and stuff like that. So a lot of fun, really great experience overall, though, for sure.
Nice.
Have you told Cassandra about this?
I may have mentioned it. I don't know if we've had a full-on conversation. I don't think she knows.
Because she may do a full career change. She might fully change her career path.
I mean, if she ever goes up to Vancouver, I may have an in for her if she wants to visit the Marine Mammal Rescue Center. If she can keep her cool.
Well,
but I will. I will tell her. Like, I've been bitten by seals before. Because, you know, we have to do, before they're going to be released, we have to tag them, and they don't like that. And I don't know if you know this or not, but seal pups are vicious. Like, they're roly-poly and like sea dogs and whatever, but like, they don't want to be pierced. So when you've had to like lift them up, I've been actually bitten. I remember in one day, three times, and I had to get a note from the head veterinarian saying, you know, for me to bring to my doctor. Because if you go to a doctor just without a note from your vet and say, like, hey, I was bit by a seal, they're going to be like, well, why? what are you doing? So it had like the full treatment instructions on what to do to fight infection and all of that stuff. So I have pictures. Maybe next, I'll show you on Saturday, April.
Crazy.
They're pretty nasty.
Wow. Okay, I'm up for it. I want to see them.
Yeah, working with marine animals in general is, like you said, it's not glamorous, right? It involves getting dirty and messy. And we don't often see that on social media when we think we want to work with marine animals.
No.
Another initiative you were involved in was the Ban the Bottle project at the Vancouver Aquarium. Can you tell us a little bit more about your involvement on that project?
Yeah, absolutely. It was such an amazing project to be a part of. For me, my time at the aquarium, you know, I had a very diverse volunteer experience. And this was actually part of that, where I was volunteering on the green team, which is just an internal team dedicated to sustainability practices. But my role at the aquarium was actually managing, you know, kind of the customer experience. So what I learned from this experience was how many people are involved in a decision like this? You think, you know, the Vancouver Aquarium is a conservation organization mostly. So you'd think, hey, banning the plastic bottle, that seems like a natural step. No problem. Get rid of them. Right. However, right. It has many, many implications. And, you know, coming from a visitor experience standpoint, you know, there's so many things to consider, like accessibility and tourists that are coming through who won't have access. And, you know, you have people coming into the park who, you know, on hot days, who don't have access to regular drinking water except to buy a plastic bottle. So, you know, it was a complex feat that involved probably 30 different people from various departments to make a decision. And I mean, you know, a bit of bureaucracy in it, of course, because you have contracts and stuff like that. But, you know, the great thing is everyone was behind it, of course, right? It's just one of those things where it's like, of course, we have to do this. But it's, you know, figuring out those hoops to jump through that are often the case with any kind of ban that goes into place, because it's going to affect someone negatively in one way, shape, or another. So we were able to do that, you know, within a few months, which was great. And the way we were able to do it was, you know, by offering refill stations throughout the aquarium and encouraging people to bring their bottles and to fill them up, and offering bottles or reusable glasses in the cafe before COVID, of course, to be used and things like that. So it was very well received, because of course that was something that you hear all the time as a conservation organization, where, you know, why in the heck are you promoting single-use plastics? Right. So even if they are recyclable, we, you know, it's a common thing we've heard that, you know, over 90% doesn't make it into the appropriate spot and ends up back into our environment some way or somehow. So a really great initiative to be a part of. And I'm so proud that they, you know, paved the way for an initiative like that.
Yeah, it sounds pretty awesome. And you said that, you know, that stuff ultimately makes it back into our environment. You know, we've all, like as scuba divers, we've all done site cleanups and stuff, but you've done some bigger coordinated cleanups with like large retail corporations and such. What's that like?
There's some bureaucracy, of course. I mean, the great thing is so many people want to help. They just don't know how. And all it takes is one person to say, hey, I'm going to do this. You want to come along with me? And that was really a great experience to be a part of. I can think of one job in particular that I had in my career, where I was working at Target. So when they opened up, and I very quickly, because of my passion for volunteerism, especially when it comes to the environment, was, you know, very heavily rewarded in giving me this position, because it wasn't something that they often did, but because it was something that I loved to do so much. And of course, we almost exclusively did shoreline cleanups. But again, it's just a really great thing, because you just throw it out there that you're doing it, and so many people just want to be a part of it. And my gosh, I'd say sometimes we had about 50 people volunteering, and there was nothing in it for them aside from just going out and like literally picking up garbage. And it wasn't always near a nice, pretty beach. It was, I remember one time, it was, for any of you who are listening who might be familiar with Metro Town in Burnaby, under the SkyTrain. So not a glamorous spot, but it was close to where our store was. And, you know, you made a difference and you could see that impact. And then you also have that sense of ownership where you see someone throw their litter in that area and you're like, hey, like, I just cleaned that. It's like you're at home and someone throws their dirty laundry on the ground and you're like, no, like, pick that up. And then you have those conversations. So, you know, doing big corporate events like that, I think you just have such a wide reach. And, you know, it's not often the people who are more sustainably focused and minded, but it's just presents such a great learning opportunity, you know, because I think with the dive community, when we do the dive cleanups, we're all very aware of the issues because we are all, you know, conservationists in one way, shape or another, because we love the ocean and we want the best for it. We want to take care of it. But when you do these big corporate events or even just public ones for people to join, it's kind of like a gateway to conservation. And you really get to engage people through sharing the impacts and getting people to be like, oh my gosh, this is disgusting. Like, who does this? Right. Mm. And so I think it's just been a really great learning experience to get me to where I am today doing what I do.
That's awesome. Yeah. And a great way to get people to take ownership in their community too. So, well, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with more from Natasha Tuck.
This episode of Dive In the Podcast is brought to you by Torpedo Rays Scuba.
You can find them online at torpedorays.com.
They've been teaching Canada how to dive for 25 years and are a proud sponsor of this podcast.
If you're in Atlantic Canada and want to take a course or see the shop, stop in and see us in Dartmouth and check out the huge selection of scuba, apnea, surf gear, and much more.
Dive tours are available for locals and visitors to experience all that our ocean playground has to offer.
TorpedoRays.com has a vast selection of dive gear at unbeatable prices, with free shipping available in Canada and quick shipping throughout North America.
So visit TorpedoRays.com or stop in the shop and you might even see one of us there.
Hey, it's Enchante Gallardo. I am the U.S. national record holder for constant weight bifins in freediving, and you're listening to Dive In the Podcast.
Welcome back to Dive In the Podcast. We're speaking with Natasha Tucker. Natasha is a Nova Scotian diver, CFOX member, and the executive director of Plastic Oceans Canada. So, Natasha, before the break, you were chatting with us a little bit about the volunteering experience. And so that must have prepared you quite well for your current role, I would imagine, as the executive director of Plastics Oceans Canada. Can you tell us a little bit about POC?
Yeah, of course. So Plastic Oceans Canada is a division of the international organization Plastic Oceans. They're based out of the U.S. So, you know, in addition to the Canadian organization, we also have branches in Mexico, Europe, and Chile. So really cool to be a part of an international organization that has such a huge reach. Really great because, you know, the international organization has all of these initiatives that, you know, trickle down into all the various divisions for us to execute at our own level. But then we also have the room to do initiatives that are specific to, you know, Canada or wherever the region may be. So it's really great to be able to have this global focus, but also, you know, to be able to focus on our own country's needs.
Mm-hmm. And what does your role at Plastic Oceans Canada involve?
A little bit of everything. So as the executive director, I mean, we're a fairly small nonprofit. I mean, aside from the fact that we have global reach, it's a fairly small team. So, you know, there is a board of directors and then there's myself and I have a few staff across Canada. And, you know, for my role, it's really building connections with a lot of organizations. So something I've really enjoyed so far is, you know, reaching out to all these organizations that are doing such cool stuff. You know, there's we're focusing a lot on circular economy solutions. So I've been spending a lot of time connecting with people who are trying to recycle plastic and find solutions. For example, here on the East Coast, how do we manage all of this fishing rope waste that we have here? And it's a unique issue because, you know, if you look at areas like BC, they don't have the same issues as we do when it comes to the rope and the traps and whatnot, because they have an entirely different industry. So for me, that's been a major part of what I'm doing, is trying to, you know, find out what everyone's doing and connecting them and trying to find solutions through all these connections that we're making. And then, of course, you know, highlighting the initiatives that we're doing, which, you know, we'll chat more about later. But, you know, just really trying to bring awareness about the plastic pollution crisis to people and do it in a way that is positive and uplifting and motivating and not, you know, doom and gloom, because that doesn't help anyone when we just focus on how bad the issue is, but with no solution. So, you know, in the role, there's a lot of everything that I get to touch on, which is really great for me. I very much enjoy having a multifaceted role. So it's been a lot of fun so far.
Your background is in business management and retail and tourism. I guess one question is, how did you get involved with Plastic Oceans Canada? And so how did you pivot into a role in ocean issues? And sort of second part to that question would be, what do you bring to the table that maybe, you know, somebody that studied marine science might not?
Yeah, pivot is really the word lately, isn't it? For me, I mean, like I said, all of my experience is mostly, you know, professionally speaking, is in customer service and business management and all of that. And I mean, you know how when you're young, you do something and you're good at it and you just kind of stick with it. Right. So I know for me, I've always wanted to work with animals. Again, animal welfare is the core of everything that I do. So I wanted to be a vet. That didn't work out. So I went into business because that's what I was good at. I was good at talking to people and I was good at leadership and all of that. And that just really led me through my career. And, you know, there's always that nagging feeling though, when something just isn't quite what you want to do, you know, you're like, I'm good at this. But is it really, like, it's not serving a purpose for me. It's not meaningful. And, you know, and that's not to discount, you know, what other people are doing in those specific industries. But for me, I just wanted to have a bigger impact. But, you know, imposter syndrome is a very real thing when, you know, you aren't a formally trained marine biologist, but you want to be so bad. So, you know, at the aquarium, I can talk like a marine biologist, but I'm not. So, you know, I really threw myself into as many volunteer opportunities as I could, just because that gave me the satisfaction of having an impact, because my jobs at the time didn't, you know, I made great connections, but they weren't fulfilling. So I really think it's all the volunteer experience that I had through, you know, even in my retail career, finding any way to pivot into sustainability and ocean conservation, even selling clothes at Target or slinging coffee at Starbucks or whatever it looks like. You know, and I really think that gave me a different outlook on sustainability and how to talk to people about it. Because, you know, often with people with strong science backgrounds, it can be difficult to communicate in a way that makes sense. Again, that's uplifting and not doom and gloom. So I really think that that's helped me in this role, in being able to make those positive connections and do it in a way that is motivating and inspiring. And again, coming from a background where I'm not going to sling really heavy scientific words at you. I'm probably not going to know, you know, a lot of the scientific stuff and stats and whatnot, but I'll find out and I'll understand the impact and be able to explain it to you there. So I think that's been pivotal in my role here too.
Cool. You mentioned how, like, the visit to the aquarium was sort of pivotal in sort of, you know, making you care about the oceans and getting you into diving. I was wondering, how do your diving experiences inform your current role or your current job?
It just reinforces what I'm doing. I mean, you know, fortunately, in the dives that I've done, it's pretty clean. So, you know, it's not like I'm often reinforced by how much garbage I see in the water. I mean, I personally have not seen that. And maybe that's because a lot of our dives that I've done are shore dives. And perhaps once we go a little bit deeper, we might see some more things. But really, for me, it's being able to reconnect myself with the ocean and understand my why and why what we do is so important. I see most of the debris and plastic that's in our waters. I see it on the beaches, but I know that it's getting its way into the ocean. And it really just brings me back to some of the experiences that I had that were, they're embedded in my brain at the aquarium. Again, this, the sea lion with a strap around its neck. So every time you see a packing strap, cut it, just cut it. Mm. Anything that's a loop, just cut it, because it's going to end up entangled around something. So, you know, in diving, it really just makes me circle back to how important it is to take care of what we love, because it's not a mess now, but it doesn't mean that it won't be if we don't smarten up.
What are some of the exciting projects that Plastic Oceans is involved with?
So, you know, as I mentioned, Plastic Oceans International has a few initiatives that, you know, as a Canadian division, we certainly will talk about a little bit more. But a few of them that are really exciting. The first one, I know this podcast is going to launch right as we're coming into it. It's called Trees and Seas. So this is really, it's not so much an initiative, but it's a really cool celebration. So of course, Plastic Oceans talks a lot about, you know, the health of our oceans and the issues facing it. But the Trees and Seas event is really to talk about how we're all connected. So especially relevant for Canada right now with some of the issues we're facing in BC and the old growth forests and the extreme heat waves that we're facing. So it really just helps to tie in how our forests and our ocean health, they're all connected. We can't have one healthy forest without a healthy ocean. So it's really full circle. So we're having some really fun events. Many of them are across Canada. So we have some events in Vancouver, Montreal, Toronto. There's quite a few in Halifax for our local divers. Nice. So that's going to be really fun. We'll be doing some tree planting, cleanups, all that good stuff. And then another initiative is the Blue Communities Initiative, which is one that, you know, personally for me is so exciting and so important. And this is really an initiative where, you know, throughout the world, we highlight areas and they don't necessarily need to be coastal, but they're areas that are connected through water. And we will highlight those areas in partnering organizations that are doing a lot of great work to make a difference. So, you know, some of the communities are, you know, the Mayan Riviera, and, you know, we work with organizations that are helping to rejuvenate and revitalize sea turtle populations. You know, we have some work happening in the Galapagos as a blue community. And most recently, the very first Canadian blue community is actually in Mahone Bay, Nova Scotia. And that's in partnership with Coastal Action, a local organization. And we specifically feature their Ocean Friendly Nova Scotia program, which basically encourages restaurants to eliminate single-use plastics, popular items like straws and things like that. So that's a really cool initiative. And then one that I'm so excited for, and again, very relevant in Canada right now, is the Rethink Refill program. So this is coming soon, and it's about, you know, how do we find these communities that are so reliant on single-use plastics, specifically through drinking water, and provide them with drinking water or access to that through, you know, water fountains or whatever it may be, so that, again, the plastic pollution is cut off at the source there, and we're providing them with better, more sustainable alternatives. And then from the Canada side, a program that we're launching in the fall that we've been working really hard on, and I can't wait for it to start. It's called the Circular Economy Ambassador Program. So this is basically being rolled out across high schools in September. We have a bunch of participants signed up, many in Nova Scotia, many in BC, and students are going to be going and doing cleanups. So whatever their local waterway looks like, and they're going to be collecting all the data, telling us what plastics and whatnot they're finding. But aside from just doing the cleanup, they're going to be given resources to focus on how it can come back into our economy, whether it's through recycling or repurposing or even, you know, taking some of the plastics, if they can't be recycled, how can they be put through specific, like, really cool machines? I don't know if you guys have seen them or not, but they're these plastic shredding machines. So they'll take plastic and they'll shred it like a big paper shredder, and it turns them into like little plastic flakes. And then these plastic flakes can be melted down and then extruded or injected into a mold to be turned into a second life product. So our goal with that is to, you know, give the students back some of the debris that they've collected in another form. So it's really cool. We have, you know, over 400 students confirmed, and, you know, we were highlighting just high school students, but it's actually gone from people ages 12 to, you know, university level for the interest. So pretty exciting. We can't wait for it to get started. Mm.
That's nice. Pretty awesome. Lots of great initiatives there for people to be involved in.
Absolutely.
I was just wondering, how has the pandemic changed the landscape for combating plastic pollution? I'm sure that's a huge, huge topic, but I mean, I'm just thinking about, you know, just from the sense that we throw away masks on one end, and on the other end, you know, all the takeout that all of a sudden we were used to, you know, reusable mm-hmm. containers, and now it's just, you know, back to one single-use plastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's had a significant impact. I mean, you know, in the ways that you mentioned that, and then even in, you know, the ways of direct action. So, you know, one of the four pillars for Plastic Oceans is activism. And that's like getting on the ground, doing the cleanups. And, you know, with COVID gathering rules, we weren't able to do that. So we're all very anxious to get back out there and do that. And again, back to what you said, Nick, too, right. It's been massive, the impacts of single-use masks, gloves, and then again, even the rise in takeout containers. You know, I've had so many people connect with me on an individual level asking, like, how do I change this? Because, you know, you go to a restaurant like you used to before, and, you know, you do your very best as a consumer to be responsible and to bring your own containers, and, you know, whatever that looks like for you. And it won't be accepted. And the unfortunate part is, and again, this, I'm not a scientist, but there mm-hmm. have been studies that I've seen come through that state it's not transmittable in that form. Perhaps mm-hmm. who knows what'll happen with these variants and whatnot. But, you mm-hmm. know, as it stands currently, that's not a threat. And if we can accept cash, we should be able to accept people's reusables as we were before. Mm-hmm. You know, coming from someone who's worked in, you know, the Starbucks kind of industry, you know, that was something where we had to manage constant hand washing. And for me, from that perspective, I find it very unrealistic to say that we can't take these personal items because it's a threat. Right. So it has had a significant impact. And I hope to see these changes coming through sooner rather than later. Because again, you know, I challenge everyone to walk down the street and tell me how many masks you find in a 15 minute walk or around a block. I know in my area, I counted and picked up 6 the other day. So it's really devastating to see the effects. So I hope we can start getting back on track and getting back mm-hmm. to our reusables.
Yeah, I found one in the ocean today. So
I saw that. That's there you go. Stark reminder, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're collecting them, cut the loops, please.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point for sure. And I was just thinking of Nick's picture there from his Instagram earlier when I saw that. Would you say that's the, you know, biggest ocean plastic issue right now in Canada, or is there something else?
I mean, that's certainly a big contributor. I mean, it depends. Are you talking quantity or volume, right? So, I mean, cigarette butts are pervasive. They're huge. You know, I did a cleanup yesterday, actually. In it's kind of a just in on the Dartmouth waterfront there mm-hmm. and I picked up probably over 100 cigarette butts in like 2 minutes, not even.
Yeah.
So that's a really big one. But I mean, it's takeout containers is really the number one thing that we're finding now. Masks are, of course, you know, up there. Mm-hmm. I'm really pleased to see, you know, that we're not seeing a lot of straws. I didn't see many straws at all, but I think, you know, one that's specific to our location, instead of like versus an overall Canadian issue, would be mm-hmm. fishing gear here. Mm-hmm. I'm astounded at how many lobster traps we find that are washed up on shore, or the massive tons and tons of rope. And the unfortunate part is there's very little solutions for those. You know, they're in the works, but as it stands right now, you know, those often just end up in the garbage, or they don't get collected because you have to pay to get rid of them. So as a concerned citizen, if you bring lobster traps to various areas, you might get charged to try and get rid of them. So, that's a big reason why many fishermen also don't, dispose of their traps that are no longer good because they have to pay. And many of them just pile them up on their properties, as you may have seen if you drive through the Eastern Shore or any fishing communities.
Yeah, and it's crazy too that a lot of the rope is sort of plastic based these days, right? So that as soon as it weathers or takes a little bit of sun, it just kind of breaks down really, really, really fast.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
Another issue kind of want to ask you about, because it is July. Can you tell us a little bit about Plastic Free July and what that's all about?
Yeah, absolutely. So Plastic Free July is basically a month that we dedicate to eliminating your plastic. So this could be in a variety of ways. I mean, I know my first introduction to Plastic Free July was literally a challenge to fit all of my month's plastic into a mason jar, like a standard size mason jar. On my first day, I failed because I went and got groceries, and it was such a huge aware. It was very discouraging, I'm not going to lie, in that moment, as someone who was very new to, you know, sustainability and to who was just kind of waking up to the impacts of plastic on our environment. So, you know, going to a grocery store and having my mason jar in mind, I was like, oh, I can't buy this box of strawberries or this my snacks or my yogurt or literally everything in that grocery store is in plastic for the most part. Even your fruits and vegetables. My favorite, not really, was going to this store. It's called TNT in Vancouver. May have heard of it. And I walked in. I still have this picture. It's on my Instagram. So it's literally tangerines individually wrapped in plastic. I walked in and I saw that. I left because I just couldn't. I was about to yell at someone. So, you know, Plastic Free July, you know, I really like to make it about not eliminating all plastics, because that's literally impossible in today's economy. And you know, unless you live off of the land or whatever that looks like, it's impossible. So I like to make Plastic Free July about focusing on one thing. And that's my general mantra when it comes to single-use plastic elimination, is don't overwhelm yourself, because you're just going to not do it. So for me, April, you might know this, I'm a bit of an iced coffee addict. I love it. And with this thing where people won't take your personal cups, having a big issue with it. So for me, my challenge is no iced coffee unless they'll put it in my own personal cup.
Ooh.
It's been rough. Not going to lie. But again, it's the sacrifice we make, because, you know, one thing that really resonates with me is I saw this like meme on social media where it said, it's only one cup, said 7 billion people.
True.
And that to me was just such a, like right in the gut, because it's so true. You know, how many times have I been like, oh, it's just one cup, I'll recycle it. But at the end of the day, if you think, you know, 90% of our plastics don't make it into recycling or being repurposed, well, only 1 in 10 cups that you use is actually going to be put where it should be. Something to think about.
I had a friend, we were out freediving, this is a couple of years ago, and he was handing everybody out bottles of plastic water, bottled water in plastic bottles. And I was like, well, you know, maybe we can do this a little differently. He was like, well, it all gets recycled anyway. And I think, and I, you know, not to sort of, you know, put the person on the spot, but I think it was just a general lack of awareness of what then happens to the material, right? And we just have this assumption that it's going to, there's a recycle bin, oh, then it must get taken care of, right? But that's hardly the case often.
Yeah. Well, it's a huge misconception, because like even someone I work with a lot on recycling and awareness is my dear dad. Because I know, you know, growing up in Newfoundland, even I remember when I lived in Newfoundland, you know, in high school, everything just went in the garbage. There's no recycling. Mm-hmm. Like plastic, I was, even as someone who wasn't super hyper focused on it at the time, I was like, I'm putting all of this in the garbage. This is what we do here. So, you know, you can imagine coming again to a place like Nova Scotia, which I very much value the effort that goes into sorting and whatnot here, because a lot of people may not realize we recycle a lot more things than other provinces do. You know, for example, the stretchy types of plastics, you can't recycle that curbside in Vancouver, or at least you couldn't when I lived there. That had to go to a special facility to be recycled. You could only recycle things with the little symbols on them. So, you know, it's a really overwhelming thing if you try to recycle and sort properly. It's like, did you know pizza boxes aren't recyclable if they're soiled? you know, like, so there's all these little nuances, mm-hmm. That, you know, people don't understand, or even the new trend to try and curb single use plastic would be like bioplastics or things that are compostable plastics. But I know, I see you, Nick. Nope. That is, yeah. That is like one of the most, the biggest forms of greenwashing. Cause yeah, they very well
just
could
makes us
be.
Feel good.
Yeah. It just makes you feel good as a consumer. But in actuality, unless they're going to a specific facility with very specific conditions, which there aren't any here in Nova Scotia, it's worse off than some of the other items, some of the other plastics that you could use that are actually recyclable. So it's really just very confusing for someone. And it's a big rabbit hole for when you do want to do your own research. So, you know, I recommend it if you feel like getting into that, but otherwise I just like to focus on the reduction overall.
Right. So you tie a whole number of different issues there together. And obviously you have a group that's a charity that's focused at addressing this, yet we know that there are over 193 countries that have signed on to the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. And encompassed in those goals, you have things like Goal 14, which is, you know, addressing life below water, which also speaks to the need to remove plastics from water. You have Goal 12, which is like responsible consumption and production, which also encompasses these pieces that you're chatting about, in terms of how you produce things, how you recycle things. And so I'm curious then, if we have the world, per se, on board with these SDGs and trying to accomplish them, then why are we having these issues? And more so, why is it falling to charities like yours to address it? Should it not be the responsibility of governments that have pledged to achieve those goals in the first place?
Absolutely. You're 100% right. And I think the new movement that seems to be coming into play is putting the onus on the, not the governments necessarily, but the manufacturers and the producers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, like through those goals, of course, with our Blue Communities Initiative, that's a very, very big part of it. All of our Blue Communities that are involved fall into at least three of those areas. So, you know, we're making impact there, but you're right. It's coming down to nonprofit organizations and charities to do the legwork. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important in the sense that nonprofits, you know, we get the attention on this kind of stuff, right? Because we're constantly talking about it. And the unfortunate part is we have the corporations taking advantage of people and basically, you know, for example, Coke, one of the biggest plastic producers in the world, tried to slap, a new bottle made out of recycled materials while simultaneously launching a product line of Coke bottles in reduced sizes in plastic containers that were not recycled. So, you know, it's hugely hypocritical. And again, that's where our focus needs to be. So I think, you know, the role of charities in this is to really get people involved and create that awareness and that change in people on a consumer level, so that consumers can, you know, vote with their dollar and choose not to support these companies or speak out. And I think that's really one of the most important things. And why I do what I do is because you can have such huge impact, and it's easy to get overwhelmed, but, you know, small steps make big change. And the more and more we advocate for this change, you know, the more prevalent it will become. You know, I think of an example, you know, toothpaste has been one of my nemesis. Like, have you ever heard of a good plastic-free toothpaste that's accessible in a grocery store? No? Mm. Well, I found one. I found one the other day. And I think this is a great example of, you know, how consumers are creating change. It's slow. It's way too slow. But at the end of the day, it's coming. You know, mm-hmm. I found one in a mainstream grocery store where I didn't have to go to three different stores to find a product. So the more we as consumers take action, the more the corporations will have to listen.
Yeah. And I think that's actually a really valuable point. And specifically, I think in kind of more privileged areas, we have the ability to put those pressures on our governments to actually act on our behalf. And so, mm-hmm. you know, builds into another question I had there, which was, Plastic Oceans Canada being part of a global organization. And We know overall that distribution of wealth is relatively unbalanced across the developed and developing world. And so from my perspective, I guess I'm curious about how Plastic Oceans Canada is responding to this concept of similar but differentiated responsibilities that would suggest that because we have a higher level of resources available to us and potentially higher populations in some cases, and we're generating more waste and or exporting our waste to other places, how do we actually then contribute to that in an equitable way that doesn't put burden or undue burden or unattainable burden like on countries who may not be as well-to-do as we might be?
Yeah, well, I think that really comes down to, and again, like the Blue Communities Initiative where, you know, it's getting outside. It's not just focusing on the areas that are, you know, within our divisions. You know, there is outreach in areas like, you know, underdeveloped areas like Africa, it's Cameroon and Africa and areas in India and things like that. So I think this initiative has been really great in highlighting these areas that don't have access to the resources and helping give them the resources. Because again, through this initiative, you know, there is the awareness piece where we can bring awareness to their initiatives and the issues that that specific geographical location is facing. And again, like, I think maybe I'm assuming, but many of us have seen, you know, the areas in like Southeast Asia where people are swimming in mounds of plastic, likely much of North America's plastic that's been shipped there, and trying to create an impact. Or even, you know, an organization I follow closely is 4Ocean. I mean, they're amazing at creating awareness for areas in like Haiti and Guatemala. And I think, again, the more awareness that we give to those areas, the more we create the pressure to have impacts. So again, through partnerships with local governments, say, for example, in Chile and Europe, I know those are, you know, especially Europe has a lot of resources, but you know, I think the wave of creating change in those bigger areas, for example, in Europe banning single-use plastics, and I believe the same was passed in Chile as well, you know, that's going to encourage hopefully other organizations to follow suit. I can think of an example too in Guatemala, and that's an area I hold near and dear to my heart. I visited there a few times and was equally, you know, amazed by the beauty and devastated by the plastic pollution. But that's an area too that, you know, it didn't get a lot of attention and they also don't have a lot of support, but that's an area where they've really band together to try and get rid of their plastic and to repurpose the plastic that they have by using eco bricks and turning it into something else so that, you know, they do often burn their plastic because they don't have the facilities to manage it, but they also don't have the drinking water. So what's their option, right? What do they do? So what they do is they still have to rely on single-use plastics, unfortunately, until they get access to that. But they, in these communities, they're taking that and turning it into homes. So I think through the awareness that the Blue Communities brings, you know, we're really able to hone in on these areas that need more help and even lead the way as trailblazers for other areas too in banning their plastics and hopefully create change that way.
Yeah, I think that's, well, I would say that's really forward thinking, because I think one of the things that we tend to do when we sit in our positions of privilege to look at how other people should change things is that we project our ability to do it onto potentially their capacity to do it. And they're not always analogous, right? Like you can't potentially say that something that's achievable here for me is something that's achievable back home in Trinidad for, you know, for my family. So it's, I think it's a really cool part that you guys are recognizing that and, you know, moving in that direction to advocate for that change.
For sure. And I mean, that's the thing that's, it's so interesting about what we're doing. It's so multifaceted because again, like you said, it's so easy to say, well, just recycle it and stop using it. But we don't know the local issues that are facing. And again, like sometimes there are often political implications too that are standing in the way that we don't know. Because again, these corporations that produce plastic, you know, they're often, they might be involved in some government behaviors, right? So they might, the government may not want to cut off that source. So there's other things in it. We can't assume because we're not in it. And until we're in it ourselves, you know, we can't suggest solutions. So I really think getting, you know, the feet on the ground and really just talking to people and brainstorming. And again, I keep touting these Blue Communities, but I just think it's such an amazing initiative to connect all of these areas. And again, it's a mix of, you know, underserved areas as well as privileged areas, but to be able to brainstorm and connect everyone to create solutions that work. You know, because again, I think through sharing solutions that other places have had success with, you know, it's just a really great way to create that change. And like you said, to just be more forward focused and not just bogged down by what seems to be an impossible task at hand.
So Natasha, from a big picture view, like as a diver and when it comes to plastic pollutions, what are some helpful tips, or can you give us any some pointers?
Oh, I got so many pointers. I mean, how much time do you have? So I think the main thing, overarching, big picture, you got to reduce. So we need to focus mm-hmm. on a circular economy. So again, you know, really supporting when you can, again, assuming coming from a place of privilege, trying to support these organizations, for example, locally, the Tear Shop, refilleries where you can go and you don't have to buy things covered in plastic and packaging and whatever that may look like. You can go and bring your own stuff, and it doesn't have to be fancy. I save all my like pasta sauce jars and, you know, some of my old plastic containers that I may have been gifted or whatnot. And I go and I refill my products in those. So, you know, big picture, make that a focus and support these organizations that are really, really trying to do the work. One I'd encourage people to look into is called Loop. If you haven't heard of it already, I believe they're a division of TerraCycle. TerraCycle is doing a lot of work to recycle things that are considered non-recyclable. So like cigarette butts, these single-use masks, and a whole variety of things. It's fascinating. And Loop is really focused on more like the grocery area. So how we can encourage these large companies, like for example Häagen-Dazs, to make their products in a refillable container that, you know, gets deposited back and whatnot. So do your research, check out, support organizations like that. But on a personal level, my go-to tip is just focus on one thing at a time. I like to, you know, consider, for example, you know, I think it takes 21 days to create a habit. So every month I like to focus on something. You know, Plastic Free July, I went big, no iced coffee. Okay. So next month, you know, so I might focus on no cheese. Who am I? Right. No cheese. So how can I get cheese without packaging where I just don't eat it? But you know, so either whether it's challenging yourself or, you know, if once you run out of something in your house, be it toothpaste or deodorant or whatever it may be, try and switch to a more sustainable alternative. Don't do it at once, because you're going to make yourself broke and you're going to end up with so much more stuff, and that's not the point. But as you run out of something, replace it then with a plastic-free alternative. That's my best tip.
Awesome. Those are amazing tips. Yeah. And good advice there.
It's like it's my job.
Well, speaking of that, where can people find you online or follow Plastic Oceans Canada online?
Yeah, so if you want to follow along on my day-to-day life, which is mostly just pictures of random ocean adventures, whatever that may be, that's my name, Natasha_Tucker. Plastic Oceans, pretty simple to remember. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and it's at Plastic Oceans Canada.
And what keeps you diving, Natasha?
Oh, I just love the ocean. I love everything about the ocean. I'm obsessed. You guys should see my house. It's just ocean stuff everywhere. So it's really a mix of things. Like, I don't know if you guys have ever felt this. It's a bit of competition with myself as a new diver, just constantly striving to be better and make myself better than I was the last dive. But then it's also combined with this like zen moment where I become hyper-focused, but also completely distracted by what's around me and all the amazing creatures. And I'm like, I'm underwater. This is cool. Like 5-year-old me would be so proud. And even diver me, who almost didn't finish my certification, would be very proud. So it's a combination of things, but I really think it's just the connection to, you know, the aquatic environment, and as well as the community here. It's just like a fun social outing. So long answer, community and connection to the ocean.
Very cool.
Awesome. Well, Natasha, I want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast tonight and sharing so much information with us. It was really great. We covered so much, and I'm gonna have to, well, I get to re-listen to this podcast a few more times just to edit it, so get to really absorb that. And I just, yeah, want to say thank you for sharing all that with us.
Of course, thank you so much for having me, and it's always fun just getting to talk about reducing single-use plastic and having an open platform to do that. So thanks so much for giving me that opportunity and for letting me hang out with you guys.
Anytime. We now know who to call for our single-use plastics pro questions.
I got you.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Yes. Thanks Natasha. I still love you. You're a great dive buddy, even though you're from Berwick, but we'll have a
ringette off. Just kidding, I don't play ringette.
No. Just gonna have an apple fight and just go from there.
I'll bring the apples, you bring the rings.
Yeah. All right.
Hey, we could create a new sport, April. You bring your stick and I'll bring the apples.
Oh,
like baseball, but Berwick style.
Yeah. Yes, Berwick style. I like it.
My friends will be so proud. We're talking about Berwick.
That's awesome.
Well, up next, we've got April's pro tip. What do you got in store for us tonight, April?
So this week on my pro tip, I'm going to talk a little bit about tanks and the tanks that are the right size for the diver. I think a lot of times people come into a dive shop and they ask for a tank and everybody just automatically thinks of an aluminum 80. But there's a lot more options out there. So I know when I first started diving, I was taking aluminum 80s. But for myself, I found them kind of long, where I'm not super tall, and I could always like feel them on the back of my legs, which I found super irritating during dives. And then I switched to using steel 80s, which are much shorter. And then I also like that the steel tanks are negative and they stay negative throughout the dive. So I got to take a little bit less lead. So that was nice. But I guess my pro tip this week, just to keep it short and sweet, is when you go to rent a tank, you can ask for options. You don't just have to take an aluminum 80. You can try out different sizes to see what's most comfortable for you.
To add on to that too, if you're looking to buying a tank, there's a ton out there. I mean, we lost some cylinder manufacturers in North America. I'm not sure about how that affected Europe or anything. I don't think it really affected Europe. But anyway, at least here in Canada, for the most part, high pressure steel tanks, low pressure steel tanks, we just, all we get is Fabers. And, but Faber makes a ton of tanks. And, you know, we have short ladies around the dive shop that dive high pressure 80s, and they're tiny and they fit very short people very well. And we have, you know, big people diving, well, not as many people dive 130s these days. I think hundreds are more popular, at least in our neck of the woods. But, you know, there's everything, every size, from practically nothing to tons and tons of air and giant things slung on your back. So you have lots of options out there, especially if you're buying your own tank. So it's a good pro tip.
Yeah, thanks.
Up next, Nick's got a book recommendation. What do you have for us this week, Nick?
I do. It's a very, very simple recommendation. It's the book is called The Art of Gas Blending by Anton Swanepoel, and is literally what the title says. It's a book about gas blending. But specifically, it doesn't cover a whole lot in terms of, like, you know, deep theory on gases and stuff. It's got short little chapters about different gases and maybe some issues you might encounter with risk and that sort of stuff. But what it really is, it's a book full of formulas that are worked out in very specific ways. So if you had a particular example on if you needed a cylinder filled with X amount of trimix, but you had so much gas left in it from a previous dive, it actually shows you how to work it out, both in metric and in imperial units. And it covers everything pretty much from, you know, nitrox, trimix, helier, heliox, and also, you know, some very specific things like blending for isobaric diffusion and that sort of thing.
Is that math for those blending? Is that in like a 9-square math equation thing? Do you do math across and down to figure out the...
No, it's just literally line by line. It's like, if you want this much, you do that, and it gives you examples. So all you have to do is that. So it gives you the formulas, and then you it gives you examples, and then you could just kind of go from there. So it's obviously not a substitute for taking a proper gas blending course. It's more of a companion book for a gas blending class, or if you're a gas blender, either you know, enthusiastic tech diver at home, or you are running a dive shop or something like that, or you have a gas blender at your dive shop, that's probably a really good reference book to have on hand for somebody to refer to, because we all know that gas blending is a bit of an art form, like the book says.
It is.
And it's also a life and death situation, right? So you want to make sure your divers are getting the gas they're asking for and that sort of thing.
Most definitely. I'll definitely check it out, seeing how I'm generally the resident gas blender in the dive shop.
Amidst trying to look down at my desk through the camera.
I know. I'm just like, wait, what do you got there, champ? Let's have a look. And, yeah, get Justin all those formulas so that we can get everything worked out.
I need to be able to do more Joe McNeil fills.
That's right.
And the really nice thing about the book, it's literally $10 for an e-book copy and $16 for a print copy. So it's super cheap, nice, small, soft cover book. You can pretty much fit that almost in your back pocket if you wanted to.
Awesome. Well, we'll check it out for sure. Find link in the show notes. And if you're a gas blender and love the book, shoot us a message on our DMs or hit us up in our brand new Facebook group, Dive In on Facebook. That's it for today's episode. I want to thank Natasha Tucker for coming on. It was awesome having her here. She's super passionate about everything she does in conservation, and you can tell it's been that way her whole life. So I also want to thank Nick for setting up the interview tonight.
As always, it's a pleasure. And as it was a very interesting topic that's probably relevant for you know, all the divers and ocean advocates out there listening to this podcast. So I hope they enjoyed it as well.
Absolutely. And April, thank you.
Thanks for having me. It was great talking to Natasha, fellow Sea Fox, and, you know, it's fun having one of your friends on the podcast.
Yep. Yeah, most definitely. We had a lot of laughs and chattiness before and after the show there. It was good times.
Yes, it was good times.
Yeah. Amit, thank you for being on the show tonight.
It was a good time. Had by all, I think. So, yeah, happy to be here.
Awesome. Good times were had by all, definitely. Don't forget, you can support this podcast at patreon.com/diveinpod and get some fun rewards for doing so. Visit our website, diveinpod.com, for all the links you need, episodes, merch, and so much more. On social media, you can follow me at iDiveOK.
I'm at April Weicker.
I'm at Nicholas Winkler Photography.
Next week, we speak to my buddy, JP Angelopoulos. JP is a local dive instructor and an ice instructor. And aside from that, he's also the Nova Scotia Underwater Council president.
This episode of Dive in the Podcast was brought to you by our sponsor, Torpedo Ray Scuba.
You can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or at podchaser.com. Reviews are one of the best ways to help others find the podcast.
Did you really make it this far? Well, you get credit. Thanks for listening.
All right, yeah, I like that. Now we can go now.
Okay. Now
you should
now
just keep that whole section.
I'm going to try to make it different every time.
No, that's good.